Greetings and welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore with you every weekday at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 WKAR and every day at noon on AM 870. Later on this hour, we're going to talk with one of America's better known advocates of pension reform. Ex-Utah State Senator Dan Lilienquist is in Lansing today to speak about pension reform, and he's been at this a number of years, has been the subject of a number of articles in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and won Governing Magazine's Award for one of America's top public officials a couple of years ago. And we will talk with Dan about how Michigan might benefit from certain pension reforms. Also later this hour, we'll go out to Meridian Township and we'll talk about the new placemaking art that you find at the intersection of Marsh and Hamilton Roads in Meridian Township. It commemorates the North-South Meridian, Meridian Township, and it's amongst more and more placemaking art that you find on the landscape around mid-Michigan. We'll talk with the creator and with the Meridian Township official about that. But first,
today's decision by the United States Supreme Court is a victory for the Constitution, victory for the voters of Michigan, and victory for the rule of law.
That was Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette yesterday speaking at a press conference about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that upheld Michigan's constitutional amendment, which prohibits affirmative action at the state's public universities. In the 6-2 ruling, the judges offered 5 separate opinions showcasing drastically different views. MSU law professor and Supreme Court watcher Phil Pacillo has joined us throughout the year as this case developed, and he's back again to break down the latest decision. Welcome back, Phil.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Break down what the decision was in this case.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the court, in sustaining the validity of Proposition 2, has determined that the voters of Michigan have the right, if they decide that they don't want Michigan's public universities to use race-conscious admissions policies to simply decide not to have them. And that's, according to the court, that is consistent with the Equal Protection Clause. And there were a few decisions that the court had rendered decades ago that suggested that this kind of thing might not be constitutional, and that was the basis for the lower court's decision. But the Supreme Court backed away from its reasoning in those decisions a little bit and emphasized the fact that what happened here wasn't the product of an effort by the people of Michigan to purposely discriminate against anyone, in particular those who are usually the beneficiaries of affirmative action policies. And therefore, it was a perfectly constitutional action by the state of Michigan to say that public universities can't do this.
What else stood out or surprised you with this ruling?
Well, I was surprised at the level of division among the justices. I did think that I did think it would come out this way. I think the court took the case because the lower court's decision, in the court's view, needed to be reversed. So the end result didn't surprise me, but I was surprised by the fact that you had 4 members of the 6-justice majority that determined that Proposition 2 was valid, that they had such different thoughts on
justification.
Exactly.
Yeah. And talk to us a little bit about those divergent views.
Yeah. Well, I think it came down to what do we do with the prior precedents. Justice Kennedy, who wrote the opinion, which was the main opinion for the court, but he wasn't really writing for the Supreme Court because he didn't have a majority on the justification. So he was writing for himself and Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts. And Justice Kennedy thought that the prior precedents, which served as the basis for the lower court's decision, should be reinterpreted. He wouldn't admit this, but I think it's fair to say that he reinterpreted the prior cases in order to emphasize that the purpose of this kind of a measure, like a referendum, a statewide initiative, if the referendum isn't serving to aggravate an existing racial injury, particularly one that the state may have had a role in, then it's perfectly valid. So But Justice Scalia was of the view that those prior precedents were just completely wrongly decided and they should be done away with completely.
Were these reasonable ways of handling what was the first one a reasonable way of handling the precedent, or could this decision be considered judicial activism?
Oh, I think arguably the prior decisions were more in the nature of judicial activism, but it really depends upon it depends upon whether you agree with where the court has gone on the issue of race since those decisions were decided. The court has mm-hmm. taken a very strong position on any sort of racial consideration by the government. Anytime the state or the federal government is considering race in any fashion, the more recent court decisions have been very hostile to that. They presume that that sort of action is unconstitutional, and it's the government's burden to show otherwise. So in the case of a public university, which wants to consider race in admissions, the public university would have to justify that decision on the basis that there are simply no race-neutral alternatives to achieve our objective of diversifying our student body. So even the kind of racial consideration that would be motivated by good intentions, the court is equally hostile to. So if you agree with the court in that regard, then you're probably going to think that the prior decisions were more in the nature of an activist court. But if you agree with those older decisions, and Justice Sotomayor was in the decision yesterday pointed out that the court has probably changed the way it's approached race since those decisions. So
much was made of Justice Sotomayor's dissent, 58 pages,
yes.
And a pretty intense dissent. Here we've had already all these divergent views among the majority.
Correct.
And yep. Then we have Justice Sotomayor's 58-page dissent.
Yes.
Talk to us about her position.
Well, it's interesting because it really reads like a manifesto as to the importance and significance of race-conscious admissions policies, mm-hmm. and that we really need these. There's no way that the universities who want to use these policies can achieve the goals that they are seeking to achieve, which is they want to have a student body and the benefits of diversity, and they want traditionally disadvantaged minorities to have a presence on campus. And she's emphasizing that it's their position that they can't do it without race-conscious admissions.
Any other way.
Correct. Okay. So, and now public universities in Michigan, so long as Proposition 2 remains in force, and the decision certainly doesn't mean that Proposition 2 is the law of Michigan forever. I mean, the people of Michigan could, in the next election cycle, decide to do away with Proposition 2.
Okay.
But in the meantime, her position is that race-conscious admissions policies are crucial, that the state of Michigan has effectively prevented public universities in Michigan from using them. And what's so interesting about the case is that there would have been no constitutional issue at all here if the Board of Regents of the University of Michigan or the Board of Trustees of Michigan State University had decided, you know what, we just think that race-conscious admissions policies are a bad idea, and we're going to do away with them.
Well, interestingly, though, some of the universities involved say that they will use, as you mentioned earlier, race-neutral alternatives,
right.
Still open to them in an effort to diversify the student body.
Correct. So now they have to. They really have no choice. So in considering applicants on the front end, therefore, they can't give a boost to a particular applicant simply because he or she falls into a particular ethnic category. But they might be able to focus on socioeconomics.
Other definitions.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, for example, was English spoken as a second language in your home growing up?
Okay.
What's your socioeconomic status and that of your family? Have any of your prior any members of your family gone to college before or law school before or medical school before? So there are a number of factors that might be considered which would actually lead to the enrollment of similar numbers of racial and ethnic minorities that you would have targeted through consideration of race on the front end. So that all remains to be seen whether that's effective. I think the universities would say it's not going to be effective enough. We're not going to have the numbers of minorities that we're looking for.
Well, the studies have shown pretty clearly that university admissions amongst minorities have dropped since Prop 2.
And that's something Justice Sotomayor even whipped out a few graphs to emphasize that point, focusing particularly on the University of California at Berkeley and how racial and ethnic enrollment of the traditionally disadvantaged groups has dropped. And in Michigan, I think the studies have shown the same, although I think the Attorney General would dispute the level to which they've diminished.
ABC World News tonight said Michigan State specifically has gone from 10% to 5%.
Yeah, and that's a precipitous decline.
Yeah.
So it could be that race-neutral alternatives haven't been used to the degree that they should, mm-hmm. or as effectively as they should.
Okay.
That all remains to be seen.
You mentioned Justice Kennedy's emphasis on direct voter involvement a minute ago. What about protection from the tyranny of the majority, the so-called tyranny of the majority, not to mention numerous state referenda that ban same-sex marriage?
Correct. I mean, that's going to be very interesting. I think he was responding, in his opinion, to the argument that had been made by the folks who were challenging the validity of Proposition 2 in this case. They were basically saying that a statewide referendum that would be voted on by the people is no way to handle an issue of this level of sensitivity. That when you're talking about race, that the debate inevitably becomes inflamed by extremists in the debate, and you just have to let the process be decided through another channel. And Justice Kennedy's response to that was, no, we have to trust the people, that this mechanism of initiative, of statewide initiative, is a way for the people to be engaged in the political process. It's a way that people learn about issues more so than if they were relying on their elected representatives to enact legislation. So he comes across in the opinion as a big fan and very trusting of the initiative process. And of course, the question will he be such a big fan when it comes to a challenge like Michigan's proposition prohibiting same-sex marriage?
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that he'll be quick to say, well, it's one thing for the state of Michigan to determine that it doesn't want to use race-based consideration in college admissions. It's another thing for the state of Michigan to deprive an individual of something as important as the right to marry the person whom he or she pleases. I mean, that's something he's emphasized in his opinions on homosexuality and marriage. He's really emphasized that that this is the way that people define themselves. This is the way that they define their existence, is through sexual intimacy and marriage. And the state just simply can't take that away from someone.
That almost becomes a First Amendment thing, doesn't
Correct.
It?
Correct.
Yeah.
And he even cited the First Amendment in his opinion yesterday.
Sure.
That for the court to say no to the people.
Is this the end of all racial preferences in education as we know them?
No, far from it. I think the Fisher decision from last year is a much bigger barrier, much more significant barrier to affirmative action programs nationally speaking. The decision yesterday only affirms that a state can, if it wants to, prevent its public universities from employing race-conscious admissions policies, but only a few states have them. Michigan is just one of five or six states in the country that has a policy of this sort. Most states, therefore, their public universities are free to consider race in admissions so long as they're doing it properly, so long as they're doing it according to the Constitution. And the Fisher case from last year was very specific about what universities have to do. So again, it could be that the people of Michigan decide in a coming election cycle, you know what, Prop 2 is a bad idea. Our public universities are losing enrollment of minorities. That's affecting the educational program. We're going to do away with it. And then they'll be right back to where they were before Prop 2 was passed.
Mm-hmm. Phil Puccillo is an MSU law professor and Supreme Court watcher. Phil, thanks for the insights. We appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we have an update on Art for Charlie, the East Lansing-based nonprofit that works to improve hospice care for children and bereavement services for families who have lost a child. The organization is named after Charlie Waller, who passed away last December at the age of 5. From cancer. Charlie's spirit lives on, however, in the foundation that bears his name, and here to tell us more about their plans, Charlie's mother, Abigail Waller, and Richard Graham Yule, Abigail's father. Welcome to both of you to Current State.
Thank you.
Richard, just earlier this week, you held your first annual art competition centered around the theme Spirit of Michigan. Tell us about the event.
That's right. Being an East Lansing-based charity, we have a need to spread our name across the state because we're trying to organize the participation of caregivers across the state to share their experience in the field that we work in.
Okay.
So we started this competition, first of all, to give something back to the artists who support us, to give something back to the art world, and to give an opportunity to publicize art in Michigan. And the result was very, very encouraging indeed. We had submissions from every corner of the state. The variety was remarkable. We specified two-dimensional art because sculpture we couldn't handle coming in from a distance.
Okay.
And we had collage, oils, acrylic, mixed media, almost any medium that you can think of in two dimensions, and a huge range of interpretation of subjects. So it was very successful. We regard every single artist as a winner because you find that with a qualified and specialized jury, which we had the curator of the Broad, we had a professor of art, we had 6 professional artists as a jury panel, and they all had different votes, which means that any one entrant could have some pride.
How many entries altogether?
We had 20-something entries.
Okay.
We reduced that to a short list of 6, which we showed at the Broad on Monday. Of that 6, 3 were selected for the first, second, and third prizes. And that short list will be on display exhibition at the People's Church in East Lansing for the next couple of weeks. And we will be publicizing that, and there will be an opportunity for people to purchase the winning art.
You can see the winner on our website, by the way, too, wkar.org. Abigail, let me ask how you and your family are doing.
We're doing okay. We are trying to rebuild our lives and redefine who we are now as a family of 3. The last few years have been hard, parenting Charlie, knowing that he was going to die, but mm-hmm. now it's even harder. Mm-hmm. It's harder living without Charlie in our lives, who brought constant joy.
Tell us about the goals for Art for Charlie. I know you'd really like to see a lot come of this. Talk to us about that.
We would. The main mission of Art for Charlie is looking after the child when they're diagnosed with an illness, and looking after the family afterwards, supporting the family through grief. And we do that through promoting art in the community. One of the main things that I want to promote through Art for Charlie is educating people about bereavement. Grief can be lonely, stigmatizing, isolating. There is a lot of awkwardness around death. People pull away. People don't know what to say. People don't know what to do. And I want to educate people that the grief generally is lifelong. We learn to live with it. We learn to figure out how to live with that loved one in our hearts and how to move forward. The one main thing about grief is it's unique. We all grieve differently and in our own way. And so that's why I want to be broad in figuring out how to support people in bereavement. And we have some ideas in that.
How many of these goals emerged from your personal experience just in the past couple of years?
Yes, they did.
All of them?
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. So when Charlie was first diagnosed, we were initially told he would die in 6 to 9 months, and we were told that it would be a very painful death. So that's when we began with the first mission of promoting pediatric hospice. And that's when we learned that in the mid-Michigan area, there is very limited pediatric hospice. So that was the first goal and mission of Art for Charlie.
Do you feel like there are others who are aware of this need for pediatric hospice services? Or is there an awareness-raising mission that you really have to embark on here?
Absolutely. Pediatric hospice is different from adult hospice. Pediatric hospice, you have to take into consideration the entire family and the impact. So there is a difference, and they're educating people about that difference.
What have you learned about how we treat death in our culture from your experience?
The stigma of it, the isolation of it.
What's been most comforting for you?
One is having Charlie's story be heard. Mm-hmm. Having people know who Charlie was, mm-hmm. that was deeply comforting. Mm-hmm. And now, as time goes on with our foundation, I would like Charlie's story to take a back seat now and figure out how to connect with other families in our community who have lost a child and hear their stories.
Now, how do you intend to do that? How will you be able to find other families who have lost a child? Will that be difficult?
It has been challenging.
It has
been challenging because of confidentiality and HIPAA laws. We are, later this year, 1st of November, we are having a conference to bring people around the state to talk about pediatric hospice, the importance for people to share ideas amongst professionals and to figure out the best ways to support bereavement. So we also hope through that conference that the Art for Charlie name can get out.
We're talking with Abigail Waller, co-founder and president of Art for Charlie, and Richard Graham Ewell, the organization's executive director. Abigail, I have to ask how it's been for you to watch the Lacey Holdsworth story unfold here in mid-Michigan.
Yeah.
Another tragic death of a child in a very public process, really.
Yes. Mixed. It reminded me, and I was aware of this, when Charlie was diagnosed and when Charlie's story became quite public, I began to think about the families whose children die and their stories are not public. Mm. So I want to remember that feeling. I mean, Charlie's story was heard and people got to know him. So I didn't feel, it wasn't difficult for me to hear Lacey's story, but it did remind me of the importance of hearing everybody's voice. Mm. Everybody is unique. Everybody has the story.
Richard, you have an event this weekend to showcase the art. Well, you touched on this earlier from the spirit of competition, spirit of Michigan competition.
Right.
Tell us again what's happening.
Well, what's happening now is that we're having a show at the People's Church. And we'll be announcing a day when there'll be volunteers there to guide people, talk about the pictures. But other times during the opening hours of the church, the pictures will be available to people to see. We were going to tie in with a festival of beer and wine scheduled in Okemos this weekend. And we heard only yesterday that the organizers, for some reasons, had to cancel. So we had the hope that we could show the art at a function where several thousand people might be attending. So this caused a very, very fast turnaround in our planning.
Okay. What other, as you take a longer view, Richard, what other events and initiatives are you thinking of for the coming year, let's say?
Every year, we started in 2011, not as a foundation, but for the family of having art events, art shows. And we had it, first of all, at a pub in East Lansing. For the last 2 years, it's been at the East Lansing Marriott, and we're doing the same on November 13th this year. We're having an art show and auction, which will be probably half art and half donations from businesses as prizes for people to bid on. It could be holiday packages and so on. We're also having a children's art show, which will be at the Broad Museum on November 1st. And will run for a few days. This is to bring art in from the schools in the area. We rely completely on the participation of art departments of schools to get their pupils, sometimes to produce absolutely wonderful collaborative art, which we show, and some from children individually. So that's again become part of our tradition. Mm-hmm. And as Abigail just said, our new move forward is for a conference to bring together the caregivers, the hospices, hospitals involved in childcare or in helping families, right from across the state. And we very much want to bring in the participation of the insurance companies, Blue Cross, et cetera, and maybe some representations from state legislators.
Okay.
Right.
Talk to us about funding here. Where? How does that fit into this? Where does your funding come from right now?
Our funding has come and primarily comes from the art show and auction that we have every year. That is our main fundraiser. Other people do sponsored runs and things like that. We follow the rather odd route of trying to raise money through art.
And Abigail, if people listening right now would like to get involved with anything that they've heard about here, first of all, are there volunteer opportunities?
Absolutely. Many volunteer opportunities. There are two categories of the volunteers. One is in our art show and organizing the art show. And also, now that we're about to give grants to families and working with families, there'd be opportunities to work with the mission for Art for Charlie as well. We're looking for volunteers. We're also looking for families that we might be able to help to begin to give families financial grants to support them through their bereavement, to pay for whether it's something concrete like funeral costs or to pay for a therapeutic retreat away. So we're looking for the families and we're also looking for volunteers.
Very ambitious. How can people connect with you?
Yes, they can look at our website, which is artforcharlie.org.
Artforcharlie.org. We've been talking with Abigail Waller, the co-founder and president of that organization, along with Richard Graham Ewell, the organization's executive director. Great to have you both on the program today. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work. But we need to find out about them. Please help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. If you live, work, or just drive through Meridian Township, you've probably noticed the large metal sculpture in the roundabout at Marsh and Hamilton Roads. The work, entitled Meridius Prime, is a 14-foot-tall piece commemorating the Michigan Meridian, the north-south baseline by which the state was surveyed in the 19th century. The sculpture is part of a plan to install public art that relays a community's sense of place. The artwork is a project of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. Here to talk about public art as a placemaking tool, Peter Menser, the assistant planner for Meridian Township. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
And Tim Higgins, the artist who created Meridius Prime. Tim, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
This is part of LEAP's Public Art for Communities project. Since it began 2 years ago, LEAP has awarded $10,000 to 8 communities in mid-Michigan to commission public art. And I know Meridius Prime will be formally unveiled today, Peter. How and when did Meridian Township contact Tim to create Meridius Prime?
Yeah, Meridius Prime. We came about, Tim, through the request for proposals portion of the art project. So what we did was put out the request for proposals, and a variety of artists from the area. LEAP limited it had to be a tri-county artist.
Okay.
So a lot of artists submitted to us, and we had a selection committee put together, and Tim's came out on top.
And what was your charge to the artist here then, exactly? What did you, how much was determined about this piece of art before you handed it off to Tim?
You know, it really was a wide open idea that to come up with something that would enhance the space at the roundabout. You know, there's 30,000 cars that go through that roundabout every day. And
but did commemorating the Meridian, was that nope. was that on the table?
No, that was totally a Tim
okay.
idea.
Okay. Well, interesting. Well, Tim, what was your approach to this task then? How did the inspiration come to design a survey marker that conveys Meridian?
Well, the call for art was well written. I thought I had a pretty good idea what they were looking for, but they left it broad enough to allow creativity. And then the I started doing research as far as the history and the background of the community, trying to find elements of the character of Meridian Township that I could translate into a metal sculpture. You know, I read about, you know, Chief John Okemos and the early pioneers and the way the map makers divided the state along the Prime Meridian line. And kind of it all went in there and popped, you know, Meridius Prime popped out.
And explain for us then what the significance is of the Meridian.
Okay. Well, when the early settlers or pioneers were naming the township, their new home, that's when they came up with, Meridian Township. I focused on that, kind of gave the sculpture a cartographic feel to there's elements of like a hash marks that look like a precision instrument. A
looks like a surveyor's tool. There.
Exactly, yeah.
And Peter, what research do we have about the benefits of public art to a community that are trying to create a sense of place?
Yeah, well, I think really there's numerous advantages or benefits of public art. It really serves as both a catalyst and a foundation for a quality public space. So, you know, it creates attachment to a community. Really, residents identify with the art, and they really kind of have that community attachment. It's both a gathering space, and it really humanizes the built environment. It gives a strong sense of place and identity, and facilitates social interaction. So a lot of those things is usually the kind of the building blocks of a quality public space, and you know, making a space aesthetically that's beautiful that people want to spend time in.
See, I like it from the basis. I mean, aesthetically, it's fantastic. But at the same time, you're kind of it's a history lesson with regard to the township. Is there a direct benefit to be studied here? Increased, I mean, are there revenue benefits from this? Tourism, job creation? Can you point to data that suggests that?
Or
squishy.
Yeah, I read a lot about this before coming in this morning, and it is kind of squishy, I guess, in the sense that it's not a dollar to jobs benefit, but
right.
It's more about the aesthetics and the community building aspects of it. It's you see often art and artists are catalysts in communities when they're rebuilding, so it really activates the public space.
Have you received much feedback to it yet?
Yeah,
I know the public unveiling is still later.
Yeah, so
today,
we're going to do that this afternoon at 2, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback just because it's so highly trafficked and people see it and it's new. There's a lot of positive feedback. What is that? What's it? You know, why is it here? What's the story?
Tell us about the materials you used here, Tim, and how long it took to create Meridius Prime.
Well, the project's been in the works for about 6 months. I used stainless steel, number 304. It's the same material that they created the St. Louis Arch out of.
Oh.
And that in that call for artists, they were looking, or they mentioned something that would gather community pride. So that's why it became a tower or a tall piece of shining steel.
Do you have plans for more placemaking pieces like this in the future?
Yeah, nothing specific, but absolutely. I mean, this has been a tremendous experience working with Tim and working with Leap on the grant and executing the project.
This could be more work for you, though, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? I mean, people like Meridius Prime. They know who to call.
Yeah,
right?
Tim's name is out in the community now as a quality artist.
The city of Mason and DeWitt Township have also unveiled their public art projects. Mason's piece is called Silver Respite. DeWitt Township's is called A Great Place to Start, And later this spring, the city of DeWitt and the city of St. John's will install their pieces. Are you aware of these other efforts out there?
Yeah, and actually they helped me a lot in the planning and coordinating this whole process. It was helpful to be kind of the second group of communities going through the process to see what they did and how they did it and how it worked best with.
I'm actually the artist doing the one for St. John's.
Oh, fantastic.
Should be unveiled by the end of this month, part of next month.
Keeping it in Clinton County, is that right?
Another wonderful community.
You're an Elsie native, if I recall correctly. What else are you at work on, Tim?
Well, the big thing is finishing up, Meridius Prime is for all intents and purposes done. Yeah. Now, the one in St. John's is called Opolis Project. And it's I work with a lot of symbols. I'm trying to tie in a lot of different community elements with this piece to bring it together. It's a Rails to Trails project. It's in the Rotary Club. It's right next to the old train depot. So I've worked in a lot of design elements to bring all these pieces together for this sculpture.
Okay. And we want to thank both of you for coming in here. This sounds fantastic. Peter Menser is the assistant planner for Meridian Township. Tim Higgins is the artist who created Meridius Prime, which is a 14-foot tall piece of sculpture, and it's very noticeable at the intersection of Hamilton and Marsh Roads in Okemos. The official unveiling is later today. Continued success.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Americans who enjoy the benefits of a pension in retirement have grown fewer in recent decades. More recently, the Great Recession wiped out so much invested wealth, enough of it earmarked for public workers' pensions, that states fell much further behind in funding them. A period of transition continues, with state and local governments switching more workers to 401k-style retirement plans. Unlike pensions, those plans do not guarantee a particular sum at retirement, merely a defined contribution while employed. Indeed, our next guest, a nationally acknowledged advocate of 401k-style defined contribution retirement plans, led just such a reform while a state senator in Utah. Since then, other states, including Michigan, have passed similar reforms. Still, as recently as last summer, Dan Lilienquist estimated the 50 states' unfunded retirement liability at somewhere between $730 billion and $4.4 trillion. Dan Lilienquist visits Lansing today to talk about this transition and how he thinks it could help Michigan. He'll speak at a luncheon event at the downtown Lansing Radisson Hotel at noon today, sponsored by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Dan Lilienquist, welcome to Current State.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Before we talk about more particular recommendations you have, I want to ask you about this larger trend we've seen in recent years. You were at the front of this movement 5 or 6 years ago in Utah toward defined contributions and away from defined benefits for public employees. What do you make of the trend since then? Are you encouraged? Are you concerned? What?
Well, I'm very encouraged. Look, this is a really concerning issue for every taxpayer in this country. We have these defined benefit pension plans, which what they are, and in the private sector, they really don't exist anymore, but we have made commitments as state and local governments to employees that that we will pay them a certain amount upon retirement, and we've counted on stock markets to grow at 7-8% every year to fund those commitments. And what we learned in the 2008 market crash is that 1 year's worth of losses can create massive amounts of unfunded liabilities that then states have to kick in additional money to pay for. And so the 2008 crash in Utah, our system, we went into the downturn 100% funded in our pension system. And 1 year's worth of market losses created a $6.5 billion hole in our pension funds, equating to a loss of 30% of our overall pension value. Well, what that required then is an additional contribution right out of our existing budgets of about $500 million a year for the next 25 years to pay this thing off. And to put that in context, that 2008 market crash cost us 8,000 school teachers in the state of Utah that we otherwise would have been able to afford had the crash not happened. We realized at the time that we didn't realize how much risk we were bearing with these defined benefit plans and chose to close our plan and migrate to a system that was not dependent on what the stock market did. So hopefully putting us in a better situation should another crash happen down the road.
You shared some daunting numbers last summer that I mentioned earlier, that altogether states face an estimated $730 billion to $4.4 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities. That's quite a bit of range. What's your best guess as to where that stands right now?
I believe it's the conservative numbers of the $730 billion. That does not include the full impact of the 2008 market losses. What happens when you have losses in the pension system? All of those losses aren't realized at once. You kind of gradually recognize the losses. Well, the lower end of that number, the $730 billion, we are not even through the five-year period of recognizing, at least on the state budget perspective, recognizing the losses from 2008. Mm. So I think it's closer to $4.4 billion. And here's the biggest thing. $4.4 trillion. Because we've made these... we are guaranteeing, as state and local governments, guaranteeing investment returns of 7 to 8% year over year, and assuming that the stock market is not going to have bad years, and so that's just unrealistic. Yeah. Every one of us, I don't think any of us really believes it's going to be smooth sailing for the foreseeable future on Wall Street, and so I really do think it's closer to $4.4 trillion.
A number of states, like ours, are in a period of transition right now, with new hires being getting on board the defined contribution plans, the 401k style plans. But at the same time, there's a number of veteran workers with the defined benefit plan still. Is this transition generally unfolding smoothly in your view, or is this a bumpier process than it needs to be?
Well, I think the number one goal of any pension reform initiative should be to meet 100% of the commitments you've already made to your current workers and retirees. And that is the important thing. When the state makes a commitment, my belief is that the state should meet that commitment. And so, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are very concerned when they hear pension reform that the state is trying to get to back off their agreement that they made with state workers. And I think the number one goal of pension reform would be to make sure that we're able to meet those commitments.
So Dan, let me ask, when you encounter a public worker with a pension and who says, hey, this was something promised to me many years ago, I've been planning my life accordingly, you're sympathetic with that view?
Oh, absolutely. Look, you know, when I ran my reforms in Utah, we had 4,500 people up at the Capitol protesting me personally. And given the information that they had received at the time, I don't blame them, because they were saying, hey, you know, I've worked 29 years as a police officer policing the streets, and all of a sudden I hear this legislator is trying to take away my retirement. When they learned, however, that the goal of pension reform and my goal was, you know, if we have another year like 2008, it could collapse our pension system. And so, you know, our number one goal is to make sure that it doesn't happen. And to do that, going forward, we needed to move to a new system that's more sustainable so we could meet our commitments to our current folks. Look at what's happened in Detroit. Detroit is a situation that, you know, this state obviously is keenly aware of. You have a pension system that has been mismanaged and underfunded for some time, that now the pensioners, where they had, you know, constitutional guarantees that they were going to be able to keep their pension benefits, are in a situation where there's no money left. And, you know, politicians have misused the funds, and now the burden is actually falling back on those people who are living on very tight budgets and fixed incomes. And I look at that and say that's a tragedy that could have been avoided. And I think part of that is, you know, real pension reform, lasting pension reform would be to move to a situation where politicians can't get their hands on you know, an individual's money and blow their money. And so, you know, I think ultimately the objective of any good pension reform would be to make sure the state can meet its current commitments, but also move to a situation, a new system for new workers that is more sustainable, that puts them in control of their own retirement and keeps politicians' hands out of it.
We're talking with pension reform advocate Dan Lilienquist, who is in Lansing today to speak at the Radisson Hotel at an event sponsored by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. In a profile of you in the New York Times a few years ago, the paper wrote, quote, "The push to switch to 401k-type plans comes overwhelmingly from Republicans who see them as more individualistic and free market. Democrats generally oppose the change, partly because their union allies are eager to keep traditional plans." Are those still the battle lines, or has that dynamic changed?
To some extent, those are still the battle lines. At the same time, though, we've had a lot of Democrats come back and realize that, hey, you know, if you want to fund Medicaid or you want to fund other priorities for the poor and the needy, pension costs, ballooning pension costs, are a detriment to that. I mean, you look at these states that are having to drive billions more money into their pension systems to shore them up. Legislators, I think, are becoming frustrated with that because they realize that this comes at a direct opportunity cost for other priorities. And you know, with my reforms in Utah, we had bipartisan support for our reforms. We did have some Democrats come and vote for them, but they understood that, hey, this is a significant issue that really constrains our ability to fund other priorities. I mean, you look at the state of Kentucky, you know, one of the houses there is controlled by the Democrats, one by the Republicans. They worked together on a joint project to get their pension system under control, and they did it in a bipartisan way, as well as Rhode Island, a Democrat-controlled state, made aggressive moves under the leadership of Gina Raimondo to fix their pension system. Now, you know, it's a really tricky issue. People get very, very concerned, but I think there's a way to do it because, really, honestly, Mark, reality is not negotiable, and these are really tough issues, but we cannot ignore the math any longer because it's catching up with us all around the country.
How do you respond to critics who say this is simply an attempt to weaken unions?
I don't believe so. I mean, look, so what we realized in Utah is that because of these increased contributions, we were going to really have a hard time paying for wage increases and other benefits for public employees for a very long time. And so we started calling our reforms in Utah the Wage Liberation Act, because right now, I mean, our contributions toward the pension system are 23% of wage. Here in Michigan, they're 28% of wages. Well, that's, you know, those are wages those are resources that are chasing bad money on Wall Street that could have gone to employee raises and other things. And so, you know, I think this is union friendly. I do think that this is actually good for state workers, or they could take more money in their paychecks instead of pouring money into a system to shore up a system that is broken.
Not long ago, Governor Snyder and the legislature enacted a law that taxes pensions in our state. This is going to be, it already is, a pretty hot topic in this election year. What do you make of states beginning to tax pensions that haven't done so in the past?
Well, pensions are revenue streams that people receive upon retirement. If private sector workers are taxed on the revenue streams that they receive in retirement, I don't think it's fair to exclude public sector workers from that requirement. Just broadly, that's my feeling. I don't know the issue as well, the dynamics here in this state, but I believe the private sector is held to one standard, the public sector should be as well.
What are you going to recommend? I mean, how specific are your recommendations going to be in your address here today for those of us here in Michigan?
You know, my recommendations are going to come along two lines. One, the state should make sure that it's prioritizing its pension payments, because if they've made commitments, the state should meet those commitments. And because they've made those commitments, the state should fund those commitments. So that's number one. A real pension reform, you got to make sure you're meeting the commitments you've made. Number two is I think they need to migrate to a new system for new workers that is sustainable, that is clearly determined contributions for employers, that is predictable and that is fair. And I think that's a move towards a defined contribution style system. If you look at what Michigan did in 1997 with Governor Engler, it was pretty impressive. They moved their state workers to a defined contribution system, and that system has saved the state because of the poor market returns in 2008 and also in 2001, has saved the state around $4 billion of liabilities that it would have otherwise incurred. And I think it's important going forward that they finish the job and move educators to a system that is sustainable for new educators, that is sustainable and predictable, because we will certainly have market downturns in the years to come.
Dan Lilienquist is an ex-state legislator from Utah. He's a noted pension reform advocate, and he's in Lansing today to speak at the Radisson Hotel at 12 o'clock noon. Dan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss a new book which chronicles the life of Lansing's prominent Turner family. Also, we explore the art of Tai Chi in preparation for World Tai Chi Day. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. Thank you, Hannah, Michael, John, and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.